Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, Vicki and Jay will discuss home gardening tips for 2022. And as always, we will wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us, and we hope you enjoy the show. Hello, Vicki.
Hey, Jay. How are you doing?
I'm doing the best. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. It's good to see the sunshine outside. It's a little cool still.
It's a little cool.
But warmer weather's on the way.
I do like seeing the sunshine. I don't mind the cool weather, but I'm like everybody else. When it gets this time of the year, I'm ready for it to be warm. And for those people who are wanting to have a home garden, they're ready for it to be warm, too. I'm like a lot of people. I started back a couple of years ago during the pandemic back into gardening. Grew up gardening with my mother and my grandmothers, and that's something that we did for a lot of years. And then, you know, ultimately I just got too busy.
Right.
When I had the time to again, especially having fresh tomatoes around and fresh peppers, those are my big things, I started back to gardening. And you and I have both talked about this, about how it would be good to have a show just for those listeners who may not be involved in day-to-day production agriculture, but these are a lot of the calls that an extension agent gets during this time of the year. And we wanted to talk about what it takes to maybe have that good garden that everybody wants.
And that's exactly right, Jay. I know that, you know, I enjoy my garden, and, you know, we've had a garden for several years. There was a few years we didn't, but growing up, my mom and dad always had a big garden, and my grandmother always had a garden. And there's just something about being able to walk out that door and go out there and, as you said, you know, have a nice tomato or some peppers, or my favorite is cucumbers. And just being able to walk out there and get that and you know, have it for supper that night. And then it's always nice, too, to sometimes to make a little basket for somebody and for your neighbors or somebody and just take them a few of your produce, and you know, it makes everybody feel good.
It's a neighborly thing to
do. It's the neighborly thing to do, yeah.
Well, you know, there's a lot of different reasons why people might have a home vegetable garden. For years, I think there was that understanding that it was cheaper to produce things at home. And I think there's been some research out there that almost says that's a wash. As a matter of fact, one of our colleagues in Owensboro, a horticulture agent in Owensboro, had done a study at one time saying that the net benefit was not a huge financial savings, but that it was a good activity for people to be involved in, and it got people up and it got them outside. And I think that is a good enough reason to be involved in having a vegetable garden. But what we all went through in 2020 with the pandemic, with disruption in supply chains, we're still going through that 2 years later, and just not being able to go to certain stores, certain places weren't open. That turned a lot of people's minds into being more self-reliant and being able to provide more at their home. And I think that's another of the benefits is making sure you have something when you want it. Personally, I just enjoy it. It's a relaxing time. It gets me outside. I get to do things.
I think it's good for families, too. You know, I know in our home, you know, our children, you know, when they were younger especially, they really enjoyed getting out there and helping plant it. But they also liked going, and when we was buying the seeds or buying the plants, you know, that was something that they enjoyed being a part of. And I think it just gets families together outside. It gets kids, you know, we talk about trying to reduce that screen time now. You hear that a lot with families, is limiting screen time. And I think gardening is just one of those ways to be able to get our kids involved and want to put that tablet or that phone or whatever down and go outside and be a part of that. And then it just teaches to where our food come from, because that is such a disconnect in the world that we live in, and it's probably been that way for a long time. But when you get a little away from agriculture, you kids truly don't know where their food comes from. And I know, you know, as agents, if you do youth programs, sometimes if you ever ask, you know, where did that pizza come from, they're gonna tell you Pizza Hut or something, you know. And so I think it teaches kids, you know, where their food come from, but it also teaches a little work ethic.
Sure, sure. You know? I think all of those are positives. I'm going to agree with you. I have a son right now who is a freshman in college and doesn't get to come home every weekend, but when he does come home, that's one of the things he likes to get out and do with me. We, of course, have a conventional in-the-ground garden, but this spring we built several raised beds.
Right.
And getting those raised beds up and going and constructed and filled and all the things that a raised
that's
bed
right.
takes. That's been a good activity for us to be involved in together and spend
and
a
And you're
time
teaching
together.
Him life skills that he'll take some, you know, when he has his own home, you know, that he may take those same skills that he's learned with you through the years and put those to work on his own home. So
I'm getting a little bit of labor out of him too.
Hey, that's the best kind, isn't it? That family labor
certainly is, but you know, for whatever reason that somebody chooses to want to have a vegetable garden, we at the extension office like to pride ourselves on having the resources to serve all of our clientele. And throughout my career, one of the publications that we have really just relied on as an extension agent is ID 128. That's the publication number, but it's the Home Vegetable Gardening publication in Kentucky. I'm going to say that throughout my career, it's going to fall in the top two or three publications that I have relied upon and that I give out on a regular basis.
I agree 100%.
We thought we would sit down today and just kindly pull that book out. And you know, we wanted to go through the whole book and put out all the tips for everybody. But there's really so much information for a small publication. It's too much to try to cram into a 45-minute deal. So we thought we might just make a few shows out of this. But we mm-hmm. thought we would take this one and just focus on what you need to do before you begin that garden. Now, honestly, we're coming up in the third week of April right now. A lot of people may have already done some of these things, but it's never too late to rely upon a few standbys. We've had such a long extended spring with the added rainfall and with
cool
the cold
temperatures.
Trust me, I've got a few plants planted, but they have not fared the best through this spring just because of the wetness and the extreme temperature swings that we've had back and forth. But any time that folks want to have a vegetable garden or want to do something in their garden, this ID 128 really makes a great book to start with.
Yes, it does. And it doesn't matter if you are planning what we would call a fairly large backyard garden, or if you even are living in maybe apartments or in an area that you really have very little yard or an area to actually plant, like Jay was saying about a conventional garden. There's also information here about container gardens. And container gardening is a fantastic way to be able to grow some tomatoes or some cucumbers or squash or whatever it is that you like, and even in a very small space. And so, and you can, there's no set container either. There you can use many different kinds of containers. Oftentimes a container that you have in your around the house already, and you just got to put some drainage holes in it and something like that, and you can turn that into a container garden. So there's information about that in here too. So it truly is a publication that whether you're commercial or whether you are beginner somewhere in the middle, there's information there that's going to be useful to you year in and year out.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think if we just start at the very beginning of this publication, the very first page at the beginning of it is plans and preparations. And there's a few things that folks can look at before they begin. And there's just about eight things here. But if we go through this and talk about each mm-hmm. step, I think it would help everybody get a good plan together for what they want out of their garden. If you've already started that garden this spring, there's several things in here that can help you as well. So, you know, I think I'll just start with one of the first things that anybody should do, whether they're new to gardening or whether they have been gardening for several years, and that's have a plan on paper. Look at the different things that you want to grow and write these things down. Draw out a little map of how you want that garden. By doing this, that will allow you to make sure that you're spaced accordingly with the size of a garden area that you have. You're going to be able to make sure you have long enough rows to accommodate the amount of production that you want. And it was just it will allow you to almost lay out a garden by the way it needs to be planted. We've got certain plants that can be planted earlier in the spring. Some things need to be planted a little closer to that frost-free date. For Kentucky, that's going to vary. But if we think about Derby Day, the first Saturday in May, as being a good, safe time, I like to have some things out a little bit before then, but I lose some things from time to time because
and
of
I
that
usually
too.
Don't try to plant mine until about that first of May. That's usually when I plant mine. Some of that falls into just looking at that date, but where my garden is tends to be a little more damp, and you know I might be tempted to get in there just a little bit earlier if it wasn't for that, but. Typically, I plant mine about May, but a couple of years ago, I had to cover it up, too, because we got that late freeze, not just a frost. We got a late freeze in May.
I remember that.
And it was around Mother's Day. And so you will have that even when you're planting, when we think we're planting at a pretty safe time period. It will happen. It'll sneak in there on us every now and again.
You know, that's one of those benefits of a container garden or a raised bed garden. My conventional garden has yet to be worked right now, and we're in that third week of April. I'm to the time frame that I would like to have already had that done, but because of the wetness, I've not been able to. But with the raised beds that I built and the fact that they drain a little bit differently, you can build some drainage into those. I've already got kale. I've already got onions that are nearly 8 inches tall.
That's good.
I've got cabbage and got broccoli planted. Some of those early cold crops that you can plant a little bit earlier than everything else. So
yeah, because those don't do well when it gets hot.
That's exactly right. But, you know, they lend themselves to something we'll talk about maybe a little bit later, and that's successional garden.
Sure.
We'll be able to turn around and have those same plants in our garden again this fall if we want
to. That's exactly right.
A garden really can be whatever you want it to be. It can be a one-season type of affair, or you can start fairly early in the spring and go fairly late into the fall with it.
That's right. And you can start off and you can start growing your own transplants if that's something that interests you and you have a place to do that and starting yours by seed or you can buy them at the store where somebody's already done that for you. And so there's information in here about when you would start those if that's something that you want to do. And I know that you and I both like to start our own seeds and plant our, you know, grow our own transplants. And that takes a little planning. And just knowing about when you're going to plant that garden and then backing that up, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks, depending on what plant we're talking about.
Yeah, I think we could do a whole show just on transplant preparation.
That's right.
There's a lot of benefits to preparing your own plants, and one of those benefits is making sure you have a healthy seed stock to start off with and it be disease-free.
And the kind you want.
And the kind you want. I did not start all of my plants for my early spring garden. It was just so cold in my building. I don't have a greenhouse or anything like that to start off with. But I'm already thinking right now about the plants that I'm going to start from seed so I can have some things planted a little bit later.
That's good.
We want a probably 6-week lead time on most things.
Most
like
things,
you said.
That's right.
Pepper plants take a little bit longer. You want probably 8 weeks for them. But and certainly a lot of our crops can be planted direct sown, you know, where you're going to grow them as well. So
That's right.
You know, looking on down this list, when we're thinking about what we want to have in that garden and how big it's going to be, site selection is a really, really key point in making sure that we have this garden be as successful one. We want to make sure that we're in a fairly level site, a site that's fairly well drained, and that we have some of our better fertile soils.
Right.
I think that's just another plus to a raised bed is you can put as good a dirt, better dirt maybe than you have.
Oftentimes that's the case, Jay. It is.
Very much so.
Yeah. And the other thing when you're selecting your site, obviously like Jay said, you know, looking at you know, making sure that it's not down in a hole where water's just going to stand. But also access to get to. Make sure that you've got access to get to it, you know, for when you're going to be picking the garden and when you're going to be needing to do some work in that garden. You know, think about that aspect, too, of you know, where it is in comparison to your home, or, you know, making sure that it's not too far up against a, you know, a tree line or something like that, and or, you know, to be able to get in there and, you know, to pick it. And the other thing is those wildlife creatures that we have to deal with sometimes. That they like to eat those vegetables too. So
certainly,
kind of knowing that.
Two other things I really think of when we think of where we want that garden to be. One, I want it to be in a fairly close relationship to my water source, because there's times of the year when we have to water, provide some supplemental water into the garden. And another thing is sunlight. We have certain crops that we raise that are shade tolerant. Cabbage is one of those things. Onions do well in a shaded area. But there's certain crops like tomatoes, peppers, and corn that really like 8 hours of sunlight.
They need sunlight in several hours. That's exactly right.
So those are things that we want to think about when we're laying out where we want that garden to be. Next, we want to think about preparing that soil properly. Conducting a soil test is always that first nature of ours, Vicki. I don't know about you, but that's one of the first things that I try to recommend to somebody when they come in and talk about
a garden. It is, because, and you know, we as agents, we get a lot of calls, and oftentimes when we get that call, the question is going to be, I've got a little garden that I'm going to raise this year, and what do you recommend on fertilizer? Well, it's hard for us to say what we recommend on fertilizer if we don't know where our starting point is. And so it's always a good idea to get that soil test. And, you know, ideally at this stage where we are now, that you would have that already. But if not, that's okay. It's not too late. Go ahead and get that soil test. And one of the things that we consistently see across the board with gardens is oftentimes gardens are over fertilized. There's more chance that it's going to be over fertilized than under fertilized, and that is something that we really need to look at, because you know, we can cause some issues if we there's a balance that we're trying to get to. And if we get that out of balance and we get our fertility levels way too high, we could cause some issues that you don't think about, and it's hard to correct. It's harder to get those numbers back down than it is, you know, just keep throwing the fertilizer to it. And so, and I just think that it's natural for us to think that, well, we've got to put some fertilizer down. If I don't put any fertilizer down, something's just not right. But oftentimes in gardens, you don't need anything other than nitrogen.
Had a gentleman come in just a couple of weeks ago, took his soil test just like we recommend, and brought it in. When the results come back, he came to pick them up, and he wanted to sit down with me and go over what he needed. And, you know, different crops remove different nutrients at different rates. Some require more nitrogen. Some don't require any nitrogen. But this was a garden spot that had been used for decades. Mm-hmm. Aside from some of the rotational issues that I think about with diseases and whatnot, he was off the charts with both his potassium and phosphorus numbers. And when I looked at it, I said, well, all you're going to need is a little nitrogen. Let's figure out what needs nitrogen and where. And once we got done with that recommendation and I wrote it all down for him, he said, now what about my P and my K? I said, well, your soil test shows, you know, those levels are plenty high. You won't need any. Oh, but I need to put some down. I said, no, actually, you've got enough there. In a year like this, you'll be able to mine some of that back out.
Probably more than 1 year.
And exactly. And, you know, that was a foreign concept.
Sure,
because
it is.
I'm sure he had been putting down so many pounds of triple 10 or triple 12 every year to build those numbers up.
It just doesn't seem right to plant something and not fertilize it.
Right. And, you know, you need to think about the crops that you're putting on. Beans, for instance, would be something that would remove a lot of that P out of the ground.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he had a row of beans, but then in relationship to everything else, he had a lot of different crops that weren't really going to pull that much P and K out of the soil. So,
yeah, always keep that in mind because, you know, we can cause more trouble. And fertilizer's not cheap. And so when you start adding fertilizer that you don't need, that's just money that's being wasted, in all honesty. I mean, sure. it truly is. And so it's just better to know where you're at, and then let's fertilize accordingly. If you don't have a soil test yet, and go ahead and get it. If it does come back that you have a pH issue that needs to be adjusted, meaning that your soils are too acidic, that we want to try to get that back up to a more alkaline soil, unless you're looking at raising blueberries. That's a different scenario because they like acid soils. But for most other things in a vegetable garden, you know, we want more of an alkaline soil. So if that's the case and it is bad enough that we think, or low enough that we think that there's going to be an issue with you being able to get the production that you want, you know, there are some options for lime that we can talk about to be able to do a temporary fix on that and raise that pH for the growing season. And there, it's pelletized lime, but that is not the lime source that we would recommend on a normal basis, because it can be expensive if you're talking about a large scale, but more importantly is it's a short-term fix. It is a Band-Aid fix, so to speak. It's only going to raise that pH for about that growing season, and then it's going to drop back down.
That's right. You're going to get a little bit of a bang on that front end. It's important to remember it's not going to have the same calcium carbonate equivalent of a good ag lime. You got to think about so much of that weight is going to be in the glues and extenders that help to hold that together to help to make that pellet.
That's right.
So, but just by tonnage, by weight or volume, you're not going to have the same amount of calcium carbonate in a pelletized type lime as you would in a general ag lime. All ag limes aren't created equal either.
No, they're not.
You want to know that source. Something you can get from your local extension office is a ag lime survey that's going to rate and talk about how well or how good a particular lime is that's sold in your area. So knowing the product that you're using and how to go about using that, one of the reasons we always recommend to get that soil test in the fall is that should give you that 6-month buffer, if you will, to get your lime down and it be making the adjustments in your soil. We want most of our garden recommendations to be in that 6.2 to 6.8 type range. Fairly neutral across the range.
Right.
We don't want to be too acidic. We don't want to be too basic either, too alkaline either, but be fairly well in the middle of those ranges.
So. That's right. And for most of the crops that you're going to be growing in a vegetable, all of those are going to do well in that range that you just mentioned, aside from the blueberries that we discussed. And that's going to need to be in a different part of your garden.
Well, in the same way with, you know, we'll jump ship and talk about flowers for a minute. I think about azaleas. They're one of those plants that need that lower pH.
They do.
Often hard to grow azaleas in the same flower bed as some other plants, just because of that difference in soil pH that they require.
That's right.
Sounds good. That's exactly right.
You
know, next we want to think about when we're planting this garden, how big a garden do we need? I think it's fairly easy. In the book it references beginning gardeners, but I think it's easy for anybody to really overestimate how big they want that garden to be. We need to be thinking about how much we're going to use. Do we all want it coming in at the same time? How are we going to be able to maintain this garden during that peak production time when everything is coming in?
It's really not a situation where you don't want to be thinking go big or go home. When we're talking gardens, that is not the time to say, well, we're going to go big or go home, because I'm afraid you're going to go home defeated if you're not careful. And you're exactly right, Jay. It's trying to figure out, one, does everybody in your family like that fresh produce? Because sometimes it might be one person that likes tomatoes and nobody else in the house does. Same thing with any of the other vegetables. Are you wanting a garden just to have the fresh produce, but you don't want any part of trying to you know, freeze it or can it or make salsa,
right,
or you know, anything like that. In if that's the case, if you're just wanting it to eat on, then you need a very small garden, because if not, you're going to get overwhelmed and you're going to have way more produce than what you're going to want to be able to fool with, and then you're going to get frustrated, and a lot oftentimes people just walk away from them.
Well, you know, we think about average gardens in Kentucky producing anywhere from 600 to 700 pounds per 1,000 square foot of garden. Think about that, 700 pounds. Now, a lot of it's water, but
sure,
still, that's a lot of produce to have to consume. When you think about I remember growing up, you know, we may have an acre garden. That was a lot of produce, but we put up a lot of produce.
Right.
We did a lot of canning growing
sure
up. We did a lot of freezing growing up. And we might have had a garden that was worked on by two or three families. You know, my father's brother, my grandparents, we all worked out of the same garden. So being able to plan to meet your family's needs and expectations is important, not just so you'll have the produce that you want, but so you're not overworked. You're not at a point where you can't maintain that garden.
Because it's you're picking every day. I mean, when this garden starts maturing, you're going to be needing to pick every day if you're picking that produce at its optimum time. And, you know, I mentioned my garden. My garden's small. My space is small. I live on a hill, and so I don't have a lot of choices on where I put a garden. And so it gets a little tricky sometimes on rotation and doing a little planning. But I tell people that call me, you know, all the time, you don't really need a big garden to have a whole lot. Last year I had 30 tomato plants. And, you know, a lot of people might have 100 tomato plants in their garden. I mean, I'm sure when you were your family, you had probably at least 100 because you were, you know, you were making tomato juice and tomatoes and salsa. And last year I had about 30. And honestly, I mean, I was giving them away. I was canning. I was, you know, my daughters were selling in the farmer's market. And we, you know, some of them we just couldn't use. I mean, you just couldn't get them used up. So just keep in mind that start small and then expand the next year, so that you enjoy what you're doing and you don't get overwhelmed, because you can get overwhelmed and frustrated quickly.
I think that's a very good point. And, you know, the whole point of this is it's supposed to be fun.
Yes.
It's supposed to be enjoyable. It's something we want to do. I always anticipate looking forward to when those tomatoes start coming in. Tomatoes and peppers, like I say, are two of my favorites, especially peppers. But, you know, at the same time, we need to be pulling weeds then, too.
Yes.
We need to be watering then. We need to be watching out for other pests. And
you get into a routine. I know at my house, our routine is you get home from work, you set your work stuff down, and you grab the containers that you picked the garden in, and you go to the garden. And you start picking, and you start looking and seeing what needs to be done, and, you know, tillering the garden, and, like you said, weeding the garden, and, yeah.
All big things. But, you know, helping to plan that garden, going back to what I talked about earlier and having a successional plan, a garden doesn't have to be a one-time event during a middle part of the season. That helps to spread out some of that workload. Having my cabbage come in before everything else is going to be very, very nice. I'm not going to put up a lot of cabbage, but I like to eat it fresh.
Sure.
Having some of that broccoli come in, knowing what crops fit what time of the year is very important. Broccoli is one of those cold crops that does really, really good in the spring. In Kentucky, in our part of the state, it actually does better in the fall for the people that want to plant that fall
That's
garden.
Right.
Not a lot of people think about a fall garden, but personally, it's something I'm going to do this year. I've already got marked on my gardening calendar, which something else, we talk about ID 128. There's a gardening calendar that you can pick up from your local Kentucky UK Extension office. It's great to help you with those dates and plans. I've got marked on my calendar when I'm going to be starting my summer seedlings for that fall planting.
Yeah, and it has wonderful timely tips each month on what to be doing for that month, and then how to prepare for the weeks forward too, Jay. So
absolutely, and those are all those things that will help you keep from getting in a rush, help you keep spread out and
that's right.
And enjoying it.
And two, you don't have to raise every every vegetable that you like. So keep in mind that a lot of counties have farmers markets that you can purchase some things that maybe you like that you don't produce yourself. Maybe you're the only one that likes it. Like in my house, I love okra, but I'm the only one in my house that's going to eat okra. So
I like it too. Slimier the better.
I love okra. And so, but it doesn't make a lot of sense for me to raise a lot of okra because I'm the only one that eats it. It's easier for me to just buy what I want at the farmer's market and go home and fix it, So keep that in mind.
At my house, that's summer squash. I love summer squash.
I do too.
It's one of my favorites. My wife likes it okay. My son doesn't eat it. But I like to put up squash, but because of the timeliness of it and the amount of ground that I have to work with, squash plant, a hill of squash takes up a pretty good amount of space. I grow two or three hills of squash so I can have some fresh squash coming in. I go to the produce auction or one of our farmers markets, one of our local farm stands, and I'll buy a 20-pound box of squash, sometimes two, to put them up.
Sure.
One of the things that helps me do is I can do that when I'm not busy with something else, that I can plan
right. When
I'm going to put that squash up. When you're relying on it coming in the garden, you got to do it whenever it's ready. You got to work on its schedule.
And it may not come in. You may not have the amount that you need to be able to put it up, you may lose some while you're trying to, get enough.
I think you made a really good point there. The nice thing about a garden is most of us don't live in a day and age where we have to rely on that garden.
That's right.
It's okay to go buy some. And personally, I like going and buying certain things.
I do too.
My juice tomatoes, my canning tomatoes, I don't raise all of those. I raise a lot of heirloom style tomatoes that I like, slicing tomatoes. Once they start coming in, I like to have fresh sliced tomatoes every day, and I could eat them at just about every meal. I could eat them at breakfast. I could eat them on a sandwich, whatever.
My dad loves sliced tomatoes for breakfast. At breakfast time.
But when it comes to making juice tomatoes or whatnot, I can go to one of the markets nearby my house and $10 buy a 20-pound box of tomatoes, buy as many of them as I want, use them to put up when I need to put them up. And I'm not dedicating that small. I have a pretty limited space. Like you, I live on a hill.
Right.
We live in Kentucky, so, obviously there's hills around.
That's right.
But I get to keep some of that dedicated space, not just to one specific part of a crop. And that's something that helps me a lot.
That's right. And it helps the community when you buy local. When you buy at the farmer's market, you're helping the farmer that's selling at the farmer's market. You're helping the community because you're buying local, and it helps you because you're getting the fresh produce since oftentimes you're even going to know who raised it. If you live in that community, you're going to know a lot of the folks that are selling that farmer's market. So it's just really a win-win all the way around.
Food security was a topic before the pandemic, but I think it really came to the forefront when a lot of grocery stores were not open. A lot of people did not have access. They couldn't get out maybe in their locality. Just weren't allowed to. So food security has become a lot more on the forefront of people's minds and mindsets. And that's a good thing. I don't see anything wrong with that at all. As a matter of fact, I think our country as a whole would be better if people were more plugged in and more tied in to some type of self-reliance. One of the new terms that I have heard just in the last year or so is a locavore. We hear about omnivores and herbivores and carnivores, but a localvore is that someone who's trying to source all of their food close to home.
Yeah.
I think part of that can be gardening, but part of it definitely needs to be supporting your farmers markets.
Absolutely.
And supporting your local produce stands and local hort producers, commercial, truck patch people, whatever you want to call them. I think part of that being a localvore is supporting those locals.
I agree. And the produce is going to be picked at the time that it's right. When you're talking about buying tomatoes at a grocery store, there's nothing wrong with buying tomatoes at a grocery store, not a thing
Absolutely.
Wrong with it. But they're having to be picked at a different time to be able for that shelf life to hold for shipping and things of that nature that at the farmer's market, they're going to be you know, fresher.
More than likely, that grocery store tomato was bred for shipping.
That's
right. And bred for tolerance of sitting on a shelf or production. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's something that we have to have to fulfill our food needs. That's not the type of tomato that's necessarily going to be the best tasting tomato for that fried bologna sandwich that you want that slice of tomato to go on.
Or that grilled burger.
That's right. So, you know, going to that farmer's market, you'll be able to work with producers that you can buy different varieties. When you plant them and grow them yourself at home, you can grow any kind of tomato
that's
you
right.
want. I'm a fan of the heirloom style tomatoes just from a standpoint of they have a different taste, they have a different texture, they have different juice contents, mm-hmm. and you can tailor those to the type of and
of
time of
want.
Year that you want to grow as well.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Very, very good. So we've got that garden planned out. We know how we're going to maintain it. We want to make sure that we're growing vegetables that really provide the maximum amount of what we want in that space available. I touched on that just a little bit with selecting how you want to grow. I've got a fairly small conventional garden spot. It's roughly 40 by 40, which isn't huge, but it gives me about 11 rows, 40 foot long, that I can grow things in. That amount of space is really dedicated to some of the things that are going to take up a little more space for their production, namely corn and beans. Those are the things that really eat up a lot of space, but they provide a lot for the amount of space that they're in.
Yes, they do.
And then I've got the other things in and around my garden built into some of my raised beds that I'm working out of. I keep the raised beds early because I could put those early cold crops in there. When they're done, I'll be able to pull them out and put something else in there for a limited time being.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Got them staggered out and spaced. So we've already touched on this a little bit, but we want to make sure we're planting the correct crop for the correct season. Growing cabbage, as much as you like cabbage and broccoli, they're not going to fare very well in the end of June or 1st of July.
No, they're
you want
not.
To get those things out and get them growing early in the spring because they'll tolerate it. Radishes, carrots, you may have some other ideas, but those are the plants.
Those are the main ones that we think about on those early crops. And like you mentioned, some of those same crops in Kentucky really do well in the fall, you know, as
well.
Very well
in the fall.
You know, and so you can really utilize and capture both seasons and be able to get those cool season crops that we like. And just takes a little bit of planning, but you can do it.
One of the things I can remember really vividly as a young child going back out and planting some of those fall crops was the fact that two things, there was a pro and a con. One of the pros was you had a little bit longer time to work with before you had bad weather. Typically, our falls are a little more seasonable, if you will, than our spring times are.
Right.
The downside to that is you may be packing some water.
Yeah, because it's going to get dry and it's going to get hot.
Right.
Yes.
But that's the pluses and the minuses, and you keep that in hand when you're thinking about the type of plants that you want to grow.
And that goes back to picking your location, you know, because you know that you're going to have to water and making sure that you have that water access that you can get to it easily, fairly easy.
Sure. You know. Some of these things that we can plant early, we can stagger and plant all throughout the summer. Onions is one of those things that comes to mind. If you're an onion fan and you plan on growing, you know, red onions, yellow onions, white onions, whatnot, when we start those, we have them fairly early in the spring. We can start them from onion sets. We can start them from seed, whatever works the best for you. But they're a successional thing. About every 3 weeks, we can be planting onions all through the season,
right.
And we'll have a little bit all the time rather than having a big bumper crop, so to speak, to
another
deal with.
Thing to think about is, it, along with that, is knowing how well they normally produce. So, and I say that because a lot of folks like cherry tomatoes or grape tomatoes. I can promise you, you're probably not going to need very many cherry tomato plants, because once they start producing, most of the time you can't keep them. You cannot keep them picked.
One goes a long way.
And I'll never forget that I did a home visit one time, and they wanted me to come out and look at their garden. I walked out there, and they said, "And this is our cherry tomatoes." And it was a fairly long row of cherry tomato plants. And I mentioned that they may have more cherry tomatoes than they know what to do with, and they did. So just kind of knowing what to expect and what you're going to yield off of that, so you don't plant too many of one thing. Another thing is squash. You know, you don't really need a tremendous amount of heels of squash, because normally you're going to get several squash off of one heel.
I'm going to have 2 to 3 heels, period.
Same here. So, because you could get too much in a hurry.
You know, and that kind of goes in. My next recommendation was going to go right along with what you're saying, is to pick a variety specific to Kentucky, but also pick a variety that's specific to the type or the amount of production that you
want.
That's right. There are tomato varieties that produce lots more, you know, pounds per plant than others. Know what those are, and that will help you determine how many plants or how few of plants that you might need for that. Above and beyond that, it's going to help you pick a plant that's going to be tolerable of our Kentucky
right.
seasons. And we do have seasons. We tend to forget that, but we have cold, wet springs like we're going through right now. We have hot, dry summers.
That seem to last a long time.
That's right. They seem to last longer than anything, I think. But having that variety that's good for your area, the zones can change throughout
right.
Kentucky. So knowing what zone you're growing in and what plants do well in that zone, I think is very, very important.
I agree.
You know, the last thing I want to really touch on when we think about planning for our garden is making sure you harvest those things at the right mature level, maturity level for what you're growing. You know, depending on how we plant certain things, they may mature differently. If you plant cabbage a little closer together, you're going to get a little smaller head. And even though it's small, it might mature.
Right.
And we need to think about that. And being able to pick it when it's ripe and not just when it's the size we want is a very important thing.
And the other thing about keeping them picked is to keep a plant producing, like your cucumbers, your tomatoes, and squash, you know, to keep them producing well, you've got to pick them. If you don't pick them, you know, they're not going to continue to produce like you want it to. And so keeping those picked at a timely in a timely way is going to benefit you. They're going to taste better, you know, and then it's going to keep your plants healthier. And so getting in that routine of picking every day, and whether that be when you get home from work, whether that be when you come home for lunch, or if you're at home, you know, whatever time of day works best for you, but make it a routine that it's more the same time every day. It doesn't have to be the same time every day, but sometimes we are creatures of habit, and if we get in that routine, then we just automatically just know it's time to pick. And so that's important to, you know, make sure you pick it. If you're going to do all this work to get ready for it and plan it and take care of it, then go ahead when it comes time to harvest it, go ahead and pick it. And if it gets to be too much, then invite your family over. Say, hey, if y'all want some, they're here for the taking. You just got to come pick them.
You know, I think that's a good point, thinking about quality, and that's what we think about a lot with maturity. But that taste will vary. I can think of a couple of different plants, radishes, for instance. Young,
absolutely.
Young, early radishes, they're going to be quite a bit more spicy than some that have been allowed to grow out and
that's
be a
right.
little bit bigger. Peppers. I'm a big
yes.
pepper guy, especially hot peppers. I love my jalapenos. That short, early, dark green jalapeno, or, you know, before it gets real dark,
that's right.
is going to be quite a bit spicier than that one that's allowed to get a little longer, maybe starts turning purple.
Yep.
It's going to have a lot milder flavor.
That's
so
right.
being aware of that and being able to tailor that to your tastes is something that's going to be very, very important. So, you know, with that, I think we want to think about our timely tip. And we've pulled a lot of information out of our home vegetable garden pub today. And I think that should be our timely tip, is for folks in Kentucky, go to your extension office and ask for that home vegetable gardening pub. It's ID 128. It's one that we use quite a bit. I think it will be one that you'll take home and just really, really put to use in your garden.
And it's very user-friendly. That's the best thing about this publication is it is designed for the home gardener. It is not designed for a large-scale commercial grower. So it's very user-friendly. It is packed full of information that you will be able to use, but it's easy to understand, and it's just one of the best publications. As Jay said earlier, it's a really good publication that you'll want to get your hands on.
It's a free publication for those who want to use it, and to give folks an idea of how much information is in this book, I just looked in the back. There's 44 pages, Vicki, in ID 128. And all of the information that we used in this 45-minute podcast came from the first paragraph.
That's right.
So it's a very information-packed book, but it's on the level that anybody can use, and we want everybody to have a copy of that. If you're listening to this show and you're outside the state of Kentucky, I guarantee you your Extension Service is going to have their version of a home vegetable gardening publication, and you need to get on in there and take a look at that.
That's right.
So, anything you want to add to that?
I just say happy gardening, enjoy it, and enjoy the bounty that you're going to get in a few weeks or so after you get it planted.
Hey, take some by your extension office. I know those agents
right.
Would be glad to take a sack of onions home or something
that's
like
exactly
that,
right.
that you helped them. They helped you grow. So
that's right.
We want to thank everybody for joining in this week. I think, Vicki, you and I have talked about doing this show for a little while.
We have.
Glad it's something that we both have an interest in, and I think folks will get a lot out of it. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.